Okay, this entire run since March 2009 lows has been run on loose monetary conditions. The only little wiggle point there was in December 2018 for 3 months. For 3 months, the Fed language was non-accommodative and markets collapsed. So we are all now officially, with the blessing of Jay Powell, embracing a new world, which is restrictive.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. 2 weeks ago in this program, in our weekly market recap, financial advisor Lance Roberts made the statement, all the fundamentals are bearish, but all the technical action is bullish. We discussed how one of them was likely to prevail in the near future. Well, here just 2 weeks later, the market action is looking a lot more shaky. But to get the best sense of exactly what the technicals are telling us right now, we're fortunate to welcome Sven Henrik of Northman Trader back on the program to discuss both his latest macro and market outlooks. Sven, thanks so much for joining us today, all the way from the UK.
Hey, Adam, glad to be with you.
Thanks. It's been a while. Always great to have you on, Sven, and there's a lot to talk about right now.
Just a little.
All right. Well, look, and I want to get your perspective as somebody living in Europe right now, because there's obviously an awful lot going on there. But real quickly, let's start at the high level like we do every time you're on here. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, it's a big mess. I mean, I think we had a big wake-up call on Friday, obviously, with Jay Powell. And I just want to put this quickly into perspective. This is really important, both from a macro and a technical perspective. In mid-June, markets were carpet bombing. We had the 10-year go to 3.5%. And this is in the S&P and NASDAQ, 25-30% down from the highs. And it was stress time, absolutely stress time. And part of the reason has simply been the fact that yields have risen so dramatically this year. Right. I mean, recall last year, the 10-year was around 1.5% at the beginning of the year and just jumped right up 3.5%. We've come out of a long cycle of permanent intervention in cheap money. And the cost of carry has been really low. People were able to afford to load up on debt. Corporations were able to load up on debt. The U.S. government was able to load up on debt. And so when the Federal Reserve finally got to the point late last year to talk about taper, that's kind of when everything peaked, small caps, tech, and so forth. S&P squeaked out another little high at the beginning of January. But then everything has been classic bear market action. Big drops, vicious rallies, more big drops, and so forth, and then culminating in this mid-June low. And this was right around the time when the 10-year hit 3.5%. The message was very clear from the market. Coming out of record valuations, this debt construct cannot handle higher rates for longer. We can handle it maybe for a while, but if we're going into this in a long-term perspective, like structural inflation, and it doesn't come down very quickly, we're going to be in trouble. Right? That's what this was all about. Now, before I'm again accused of being a perma bear, we were actually technically very bullish in mid-June. I put out the whole case about the technical disconnects, the oversold readings, which were some of the most intensive ones we've seen since 2008. So the notion at that time was, if you get a reversal in yields, you get the relief rally. If it gets you then to technical reconnects. And the classic bear market rally case was for moves back into the big moving averages, i.e. the daily 200 MAs or the weekly 50 MAs and so forth. And then you would find a process of decision-making, whether this is just another short, quickie bear market along the way, like we've seen many times before when central banks flip-flopped, or whether this is all going to roll over again for a more extended bear market like 2000 and 2008. What helped the rally in the summer was in July, following the Fed press conference, Chairman Powell was perceived to be dovish, and he kind of shot himself in the foot there a little bit. because he mentioned the word neutral, saying we are at neutral. That kind of gave the market the perspective that the Fed already is comfortable with where they are and that they may, you know, either slow down, pause, or even cut rates in 23. Remember, futures market was already pricing in rate cuts for 23. The problem with all this was, and the result of all this was, that due to the rally and the comments, and then also a hint at CPI inflation maybe rolling over, it resulted in a massive easing of financial conditions. Sprinkled in a couple of big programs thrown in by the Biden administration here in August with student debt relief and the what is called Inflation Reduction Act, which in total amount to about $1 trillion in added deficit spending down the road. These factors combined went completely against the Fed's mission, which is to tighten financial conditions. You do not beat structural inflation with loose monetary conditions. You just don't. You need to have restrictive monetary conditions. And then we have this whole psychology of all of us, all market participants for 14 years, just basically chasing every single Fed pivot along the way. Markets just went full ball back into that. I mean, that's what we saw with stocks like Bed Bath and Beyond. I mean, it was just reminiscent again of 21. The optimism came back. The shorts were covering, and you know, everybody's calling for new highs again. I mean, that was basically the sentiment just until a couple of weeks ago. And the problem with all this, in addition to this, after Powell's perceived dovish pivot, every other Fed speaker that came out since his speech or press conference in July was completely ignored by the market because they were talking about going to 4%. They were talking about going restrictive. No one cared. No one was listening to all this. And I think, and this is just my take here, I think Powell got really frustrated with all this. And he shot it all in the head on Friday in a terse 8-minute speech. And it gave everybody a head washing. The Fed's not done. Inflation is not going to come down to 2% anytime soon. And financial conditions are going to tighten in the sense that the Fed is actually going to go restrictive. And this is really important. We are not at restrictive yet. We haven't been at restrictive since before 2007. Okay, this entire run since March 2009 lows has been run on loose monetary conditions. The only little wiggle point there was in December 2018 for 3 months. For 3 months, the Fed language was non-accommodative and markets collapsed. So we are all now officially, with the blessing of Jay Powell, embracing a new world, which is restrictive monetary conditions. And I think, obviously, this is what the market reacted to on Friday and today as well. And all of a sudden, there is a big reassessment. What does this all mean? And I think this is now interesting in particular because it all happened in context of these markets tagging these key moving averages and now reversing, because that leaves open the possibility that what we just seen is a bear market rally. Now, none of this is proven until you actually make new lows vis-a-vis June, but no one's in the clear now. And I think we're now in the negotiation phase in markets. You know, that is not going to be key. What happens, I think, in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
All right. Great summarization of what's just gone on. I do want to get, as we get further into the conversation here, Sven, about your thoughts on the likelihood that this has all been a big relief rally inside of a larger bear market, and you know, violent rallies are a key, you know, quality of bear markets to suck everybody back in, as well as how low you think the tape tells us things could go if the bear market does resume. But before we get into the price action, you touched on a couple of things that are very important that we've talked about a fair amount on this program relatively recently. Probably, you know, one of the biggest ones is in the near term, you know, the past 2 months or so, the market really, you know, has been calling the Fed's bluff. And what's so funny about that is we have a market that has been trained basically for a decade or more to not fight the Fed. And Fed, in fact, that was a mantra they would repeat gleefully, right? Every dip, don't fight the Fed. Fed's got your back, buy the dips, right? And all of a sudden, you know, the Fed is continuing to talk tough and the markets are saying, no, we don't believe you. We think you're going to pivot soon or pause, right? And that was the disconnect of the past 2 months. And it seems like the markets called the Fed's bluff and are realizing that they lost that bluff. We'll see what happens, but that seems to be the dawning awakeness, the awakening that's dawning on folks after Jackson Hole. So you mentioned that the key thing for us as investors to appreciate here is that we are going from, again, a decade plus of accommodative monetary policy to truly restrictive policy in a way that we haven't seen, as you said, since about 2007. Again, Fed has been raising rates since February. It's saying it's going to continue raising them going forward. I just interviewed Kyle Bass last week, and he said that's important, but not nearly as important with the shoe that's about to drop, which is quantitative tightening. He thinks that the full-scale quantitative tightening of whatever it is, $95 billion a month, that's really starting now at full force is when we start seeing that liquidity getting drained out of the pool here, that's really going to have the bigger effect than the rate hikes to date. Do you agree? And what do you think the impact of this quantitative tightening is going to be like? How are we going to see it manifest? Are we going to see it manifest in slower economic growth and falling asset prices, or will there be a delay, or what do you think?
Well, first of all, maybe a little bit of history on quantitative easing versus quantitative tightening. Our experience with quantitative tightening is extremely limited. Okay, we had the process between 2016 and 2018 when the Fed did reduce its balance sheet by about $750 billion, which is actually not a lot. It was called, you know, watching paint dry. I think that was Janet Yellen's description back then. So the first thing to recognize there is that quantitative easing is designed to stimulate in a big way. And the way it's made its stimulus effective is by goosing up asset prices, because you get the Tina effect, you get all this liquidity thrown into the system, and asset prices react. You go back to charts to 2009, every time QE ended, we had corrections. Every time new QE was announced, we had big run-up in equities. When you had a flip-flop like we did in 2019, even though they didn't call it QE at the time, but they added to their balance sheet. And markets are, you know, let's face it, at this point, trained monkeys. You know, you see the balance sheet go up and everybody races in. In fact, last year, we just had this incredible correlation. The S&P was basically just a Fed balance sheet tracker.
Right.
That's the QE equation. QT, on the other hand, is designed to not upset markets. That's the key thing. That's why in 2016 and 2018, it was going so incredibly slow. Also, for context, the Earth is not flat. 2016, 2017, guess what happened? While the Fed was doing QT and rate hikes, the ECB and BOJ and everybody else was expanding their balance sheet. So global liquidity was plentiful. They expanded the global balance sheets of central banks during that time period, actually increased by $5.5 trillion. So don't tell me there was any real quantitative tightening going on at all.
Okay,
so this is all really important to understand. Now, having said all this, this QT here is going to be the largest that we've ever seen, $95 billion a month, which is less than the monthly QE, right? What's interesting here is that, and the numbers have always been mind-boggling, but just to kind of throw a couple of ones out there, the balance sheet of the Fed has increased tenfold since 2007, right? They were at around $880 billion. Now they got to $9.6 trillion. The reason you see everything pivot off the Fed and markets and speakers is because they are the big 10,000-pound gorilla in the market, right? So what they do with liquidity matters. Now, so far this year, in reality, they haven't done squat yet with QT. You know, they kind of tape it, they stop buying, and it's all glacial. And this is part of the big criticism why the Fed was asleep at the wheel with inflation, A, to be dismissive of it, then to be extremely complacent about it and not reactive to it. You know, if you intervene at every crisis at the blink of an eye, which is exactly what they've done, and then you're faced with an inflation crisis that hurts people, especially the most vulnerable in society, who get the hurt the most by massive inflation. And all of a sudden, what, you do not do anything on and getting the liquidity back out? No, because the backdrop, and this is where the market is perhaps right to always anticipate the Fed pivot. If you spend 14 years coddling markets and managing the economy via market direction and always intervene, you've built a construct that is so large that it seems unthinkable that the Fed has suddenly forgotten about this construct, mm-hmm. that they're going to throw this all out. Because, and this is just, you know, general basic valuation metrics, all right? Last year, you may recall, I've been throwing my hands up in the air saying, my God, what are they doing with regards to market cap to GDP? Because historically, going way back, 70s, 80s, it was around 40 to 60%. Then it kind of crept up in the 90s. Then we had the tech bubble, got to 155%. At that time, it was the largest disconnect between market valuations and the actual size of the economy. And we had the tech crash, right? And that it bottomed at 75%. And I throw this out here because at the end of the day, somehow you need to have an economy that produces enough that you can back up these equity valuations. When they then intervened, obviously, in 2000, 2002, 2003, and it bottomed, we had the housing bubble, right? That got us around 137% market cap to GDP. And then that blew up and bottomed at 50%, right? We ended last year at 200% market cap to GDP. And it just kept going up and kept going up. And then, you know, you get this thing where things don't matter. And so people say, well, it's different this time and it no longer right. applies. It's no longer a good indicator. Oh, yeah. In June, that right-sized to 155%. So ironically, the peak of the tech bubble was the June bottom, right? So... And now there's kind of this thought out there, okay, now the bottom is in. Okay, if the previous biggest bubble is your bottom indicator, you know, you have a lot of trust going forward. You know, you hear a lot about, you know, so many people being short of this, that, and the other. I just looked this up. I posted it on my Twitter feed as well. Equity allocations are still at 64%, which is historically extremely high. Remember last year, there was in 1 year, more money, retail money flowed into stocks than in the 10 years previous combined. And Bank of America is talking about, well, everybody's bearish, but nobody's sold.
Right.
Yeah, they haven't sold. There's been, if you look at just the historic lens, again, assuming it's not different this time, then, you know, we're still vastly extended in the large scheme of things. But then you have stocks like Apple, which almost went flat on the year as if nothing has happened here in August, right? And it has such a big weighting and everybody's comfortable sitting there as a safe haven. Yeah. So to me, looking at all this, and by the way, in July, we went back to 175% market cap, the GDP. Now with this flush we just had, we're back at about 164%. So on that basis, we're still in la-la land, right? That's kind of the thing. And now we're going into quantitative tightening in an environment when we've, you know, everybody kept saying that debt doesn't matter. I tell you what, it does matter when all of a sudden your cost of carry goes up dramatically.
Right.
Right. And we've just seen this in housing. I mean, at 2.33% Fed funds rate, which is just slightly above where they were in December 2018. The housing market's already completely falling apart. The monthly supply of houses available for sale is 10.9 months right now. every time in the last 50 years, you get to 9 months and above, you go into a recession, right? And by the way, recession, while Powell didn't use that word, he used, you know, an analogous word for it. He said pain. This is as close as you politically can come as a central banker in America. While you have central bankers in England saying recession's coming, while the head of the Bundesbank is saying recession is coming, you're not allowed to say that, apparently.
Right, the head of the Fed can't say that. He's afraid he'll spark a panic and make it a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. So, you know, there's so many indicators prior to us going to restrictive monetary conditions that suggest a recession is coming, you know, from yield curve, from productivity charts, from the housing market. So now that we're going into restrictive monetary conditions, you know, people try to, again, ignore this because of the rollover in inflation. This is where I go back to the 70s and 80s. The only examples we have of high inflation and a Fed response and a market response. And I've seen a ton of charts this summer that says, you know, inflation rolls over in 1982, and that was the bottom in market. Yeah, if that's your only indicator and your only variable you're working with, then that's maybe true. What's left out in this example, 1982, or in 1980, or in 1974, is that markets did not bottom structurally until the Fed was already deep in a rate cutting cycle. Mm-hmm. Why was it in a deep rate cutting cycle? Because the economy was in a recession. It had rolled into a recession, and then they cut, even with inflation still high, right? But the thing is, you know, inflation rolling over is a sign of the economy slowing down, which is obviously what's been happening this year, right? So for the Fed, for the Fed to all of a sudden see easing financial conditions while we're still high in high inflation, is not the solution. Then you run into this Arthur Burns nightmare of 70, where they initially stopped, markets rallied, everybody was happy. Well, then inflation really
got worse. Yeah,
it got worse. And that's interesting what basically Powell was hinting at by mentioning Volcker three times, but not Arthur Burns. He doesn't want to be the next Arthur Burns here, right? So I think we all have to kind of get a reality check here of what the consequences are of now actually restrictive monetary policy going to come. And remember, when these rate hikes come, they have a lag effect. QT will have definitely an impact. Sorry, I kind of went off on a tangent here with regards to your original question.
No, it's all good.
If QT comes in at $95 billion a month, it will have an impact. And I'll tell you why. Despite QT so far having been tame with rate hikes and rising yields, the monetary base has already been shrinking this year. And I put a chart out the other day on Twitter where I showed the correlation between the directional flow of the monetary base vis-a-vis the S&P. And guess what? Last year, they were just hugging each other, okay? This year, every time the monetary base dropped, the S&P dropped like a brick. There were a couple of periods when the monetary base was poking up, kind of a little bounce. And we had a big rally in March. We just had a big rally in July into August. Now, the question everyone has to ask themselves here, with the Fed going into restrictive monetary policy, with QT getting fully in gear, what is going to be the direction of the monetary base? So if you think markets can rally happily ever after with the monetary base shrinking, you're playing definitely on the train of it's different this time.
Right? Yeah. And what's also different too from what we saw, you know, years back when the Fed briefly tightened, is that time, as you said, it sort of passed the easing torch to the other major central banks of the world, where they were still easing while the Fed was beginning to tighten, where this time everybody's tightening.
And not the Bank of Japan.
I shouldn't say everybody. Yeah, change. Neither China.
The Bank of Japan is not tightening. And in fact, I cannot think of a single circumstance now on the planet where in our lifetimes we will ever see the BOJ tightening. Actually, China is easing.
China's easing too. Yeah, I misspoke. Yeah. But certainly yeah. ECB tightening, crazy.
ECB, yeah. But you know, here's again the slowpoke organization, right? I mean, we have record inflation in Europe. We just had what 37.8% PPI inflation in Germany, and they're still at zero rates. Right.
I love how they tightened up to zero.
Yeah, they managed to raise rates to zero. Congratulations, courage in our time. Now there's out of Jackson Hole, you saw a lot of very hawkish chatter out of the ECB that they're going to have to be more aggressive in rate hikes, you know, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be real positive. They're all still real negative rates vis inflation. And then if you dream of the ECB doing QT, they haven't even discussed it. There was one of them came out this week and it says, well, it may be too early to do it, but maybe we can talk about it, you know.
Yeah, and I loved your analogy about the firefighter.
Yes, exactly. You know, the house is on fire.
Maybe we can't put water on it yet, but we can talk about maybe putting water on it.
We can talk about it. We could talk. So yeah, that's, you know, and part of the reflection here is simply the fact that they know Europe is going into a recession. So can you really raise rates into a recession? Now, Isabel Schnabel from the ECB seems to indicate that maybe that's what they need to do. But the notion that all of a sudden there's trillions of new dollars coming into the global liquidity system is a fantasy. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen anytime soon. Yeah. Okay. So while that's helped maybe in 2016 and 2017 for the Fed to slowly walk down the balance sheet while these other guys were printing, that's not going to happen this time around.
Yeah, and that was the point I was trying to underscore. All right, well, look, so if the monetary supply is going to start shrinking because of all these efforts, right? You're saying, look, if you're looking at the markets and saying, well, I think they're going to rally hard based on that. I think, like you said, we all want some of what you're smoking. The way I sort of, you know, liken this is, and you've heard this analogy before, let's talk about the Fed as like a super tanker, right? It takes a long time to change the trajectory. And after many, many years of going to port, the Fed is now trying to change the tanker to starboard. And as it begins to continue to swing, you mentioned that there's, you know, all of its policies have a delay effect, right? So, as it's continuing to pull it here towards starboard, at some point likely, and I'm going to put this assumption out there, you can challenge it if you like, but at some point in the future, the Fed will pause or pivot. And likely people think that that's when, you know, the Fed quote unquote breaks something, right? It tightens so hard that, you know, we start seeing massive instability. And at some point the Fed will say, okay, let's, you know, we got to stop. We got to maybe start going back to easing policy. Who knows when this is going to happen? Even though I'm going to ask you that question in a moment, but even if the Fed says, "Okay, we're pausing. We're now going to start easing," you have this, you know, long lag of all the Fed hikes and the QT going on that you're going to still continue to tighten monetary policy for a good while, even while the Fed is out there now back to easing. The tanker's still turning to starboard, and it's only going to be a while before it can start swinging back again. So that's when you were talking about kind of back in the 70s, where you had these periods where, you know, they'd start easing again and whatnot, but the markets would keep going down because they have to reflect all of that, you know, economic destruction, demand destruction, et cetera, that all the pent up hiking had done. So I see you nodding a little bit as I'm saying this, but do you sort of see that as sort of the likely future trajectory here, that the Fed is going to hike until something spooks it or it breaks something, and it then starts to reverse course, but we're going to have this intermediate period that could last for quite a while where all the impact of all the tightening in QT is still going to keep sort of slamming into the slowing economy here, and it's going to be a long time before those, you know, I guess where I'm going, this is a lot of folks think, oh well, the Fed will pivot and then everything will magically go back to where it was, you know, back when times were great over the past decade, where asset prices just shot the moon. That might not be the case. You might get your pivot, but you might not get the results you expect for a long time after that.
Yeah. So the, and right now, of course, the next Fed meeting is here in September, and there's chatter about 50 basis point rate hikes or 75 basis point rate hikes. Frankly, I don't think it matters. I may be out of consensus here. It may matter in the short term. You know, there will always be an opportunity to chase something, right? That is perceived as relief, right? That's why bear markets, you cannot be perma anything in a bear market. I think you need to be perma flexible in a bear market, because you will get these vicious rallies. And when the technicals, and that's what we pivot off mostly, when technicals align to be bullish, then you definitely want to chase these things at the right time. You don't want to chase them early and get your head ripped off. I mean, it's a complex game. So I have no doubt if the Fed were to go 50 basis points in September, then, you know, and maybe queuing off another relief print in CPI and PPI, then that may set up for another rally. Absolutely. I mean, nothing's going to go straight down. And as we just saw this summer, these things can be immensely powerful, especially if positioning is skewed too much one way or the other. Mm-hmm. But the reason I say it doesn't change anything is, as you said, then the tightening and the lag effect is still going to be there. In fact, right now, you look at what Powell said on Friday. That's nice in terms of being now saying, okay, I'm actually serious. Listen to me. Can you hear me now? But he has to follow through with action. So you can argue then he's put himself in kind of a box here as well, because if he does not follow through, i.e. with 75 basis point, you know, it may be another credibility issue. At some point, the Fed will pause. They will have to pause. And by the way, just everybody be clear, history is also clear. The Fed always raises rates until it breaks something.
Right.
That's how it works. That's how, you know, they raise rates until we had the housing crash. You know, they raised rates until the market told them don't do it anymore in 2018, right? Greenspan raised rates after, you know, the Y2K bubble, and, you know, everything blew up. It's always the same story. The question is how much pain are they willing to take, and how long can this financial construct handle itself without any major blowups? And frankly, this was very interesting in the first half of the year. While we had some significant down moves in equity markets and individual stocks, there were no major blowups. That was actually a solid,
pretty orderly.
It was very orderly, especially talking about the VIX, because while the S&P made lower lows, the VIX also made lower highs. That was a little odd, right? And some associated with the options complex, which obviously these days is massively powerful. But at the beginning of the year, January, I had put out this notion about how the Fed maybe want to approach the year. And I said at the time, yeah, they need to let the air out of the asset bubble, let assets drop for once, but do it in a way so that it doesn't cause anything systemic, right? And then when inflation rolls over, as growth will be slowing down, because every time asset prices drops, growth slows down. The equity market, it's always been said stock market's not the economy and vice versa. Well, the stock market has become so large with so much wealth tied to the stock market that it directly correlates with spending. Bernanke talked about this in 2012 as well. You know, everybody feels good when the stock market goes up, their 401ks are high, so they're going to feel more comfortable spending things. We saw that also in 2018, in December, when they dropped 20%, retail sales cratered immediately, right? So there is actually a correlation.
Right,
so
there's a wealth effect and there's a negative wealth effect.
That's right. And so now when we had the summer rally, all of a sudden you get the wealth effect back, right? So now you can expect maybe a bounce again in spending, which is, again, counter to the Fed's mission about getting back to 2% inflation. And there's a lot of things they do not control on the inflation equation, right? That's the tricky part. And we see that in Europe with energy prices, a lot of which is political driven, geopolitical driven.
Right.
So yeah, I don't think it's going to be an easy journey at all. But yes, you're going to have rallies. You can chase things when it makes sense, but there's all the times to sell and not be as aggressive. Absolutely.
Okay. And we are going to get soon into your technical expertise. And I imagine, you know, if we are indeed in a secular bear market here, to your point about having to be perma flexible in environments like this, you'll be tracking indicators, you know, that measure things like percent overbought or oversold, to help gauge that, hey, even though if we think we're still continuing down over the long haul, you know, we may have one of these face ripper rallies coming up soon, right?
Okay. Yeah, it's point of confluence, especially when you get confluence support along with some specific technical signals and readings. Then yeah, you know the next big move is the other direction, not lower.
Okay, great. And I want to get to some of the indicators that you're going to be keeping your eye most closely on, but want to finish the macro path to that destination. First is inflation may have peaked, at least in the States right now. And again, you said the market kind of went on party mode because the July CPI was lower than the June CPI. Now, you know, went from 9.1 to 8.5. I mean, it's still a ridiculously high CPI print. So, you know, we shouldn't get out our mission accomplished banners yet. From what you're saying, it sounds to me like you think disinflation will reign from here. For the foreseeable future, meaning that inflation will slowly come down as the economy continues to slow. Some people might still call that a stagflationary environment while the CPI is still above, you know, I don't know, I'm going to pull a number out of the air, but let's say 5%, right? So you still have high CPI, even if it is decreasing, but economic growth is stagnant or you know, contracting. Is that your outlook from here? Or do you think at some point next year, could we get into true deflation? I mean, could the economy slow so much that we actually start seeing negative CPI prints?
Well, recession is the traditional solution to get rid of inflation. Absolutely. I mean, that this is what maybe Powell should have said from the very beginning.
Right. Maybe what he wish he could have said. Yeah.
Maybe you wish you could have said it. This was the solution in the 70s and 80s and 82. Yeah, you get the recession, it crushes demand, and therefore inflation goes away. That is the ultimate destination. You know, even Germany's in the 20s, you know, that hyper, every inflation spike ultimately ends. The question is how much damage comes with it in between. And if recession is the solution and the honest answer, then folks, all these 23 earnings projections are still way too optimistic.
Right.
That's why markets bottom inside the recession while the Fed is rate cutting. And it's towards the tail end of the recession, maybe anticipating 6 months or so in advance of a recession end, that markets traditionally bottom, because then you're out of that complete conversion cycle. I mean, if you look at earnings numbers this year, they're still sky high. I mean, it's actually incredible, right? I mean, obviously on the tailwinds of all the liquidity injections, free money and spending, gap earnings went to new record highs. And in the first half of the year, companies were actually largely able to pass the price increases to consumers.
Right. Profit margins are still near record highs, yeah. Right?
They're doing great. And so you look at this on a historical basis, say, well, how long is that sustainable? Right. I mean, are we now in a new era where you can maintain these type of earnings, considering that the consumer has just experienced negative real wage growth for a year and a half, considering that the consumer is piling into credit card debt because they can't pay their monthly bills, considering, you know, that the cost of all the debt they carry is increasing. I mean, just look at the mortgage payments. Now, if you're in a fixed mortgage, I suppose you're fine. If you got a variable, you're crying in your pillow. It's a really tricky game here. And now what we also seen, and this is probably the concern about structural inflation for the Fed, because the labor market has been tight, we've seen increases in wages. That's the wage inflation component. It's funny, the Fed didn't really get serious about inflation until wages started rising.
Yeah.
Right? As soon as there's some good news for you, now we intervene.
Yeah, I don't know if you know Michael Every from Rabobank, but I got to give him credit because he said, I don't know, the beginning of this year, he said, that's when you'll see the Fed act, when you start seeing central banks act, when you start seeing the wages go up. So
that's right. So finally, there's some good news for the consumer. Now let's crush them.
Let's crush it. Yeah.
Yeah. You can pay whatever whatever comes your way on the consumer side, overpay everything, but you know, we'll keep it going. Now, this is the historical frustration with the Fed, because as much as I may applaud Jay Powell finally for having spoken plainly on Friday at Jackson Hole, there's been zero accountability for what they've done. Bullard, I give him credit for actually last week pointing out, yeah, we've overdone it on the printing side. Mm-hmm. He literally said that. We've overdone it. We've overshot on the balance sheet. What are the consequences?
Sorry for laughing, but yeah, just after a 10x increase in what, like 14 years or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I know.
Like, hey, genius, we could have probably told you that maybe 10 years ago.
No, I mean, I think, you know, look, I've been a long-term critic of this whole free money system because it's resulted in historic divisions in society, wealth inequality, the largest we've seen ever. It's left people out. And I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing so much division in politics. I think there's a lot of people simply frustrated, and then they're easy to polarize on the political front. Housing, you know, you look at the younger generation, they're completely priced out. Housing affordability is the lowest, even then below than 2007. They've created this monster, and they've done it by too much printing and too loose policy for too long. When there was fiscal record stimulus going through the system, they should have stepped back. They said, okay, enough. Yeah, but they didn't. And there's been no accountability since then. And so now we're, you know, first we made the rich richer, then we hurt the poor with inflation, and now let's crush them with the cost of carry. I don't know how that's a long-term viable solution for a healthy economy and society. But hey, I like surprises.
Yeah, well, it's not, and I'm glad you mentioned that. So I'm just going to read the quote that you just paraphrased there, but this, you said this on Twitter the other day. First, we made the rich insanely rich, then we let inflation run wild, and now pain for the most vulnerable, right? So you and I have been long-term critics of the Fed and the central banks, I think largely for this reason at the core, right? It's the deformations of the cost of money and the price of assets, which are, no surprise, largely owned by the already rich, right? And so the rich's advantage has just continued to grow. And part of the reason for no accountability, I got to think, Sven, is because the people who run the system are the people who are benefiting most, right? So why are they going to challenge something that is just continuing to, you know, improve their advantage across the system? And this history shows the only time they really care is when the public gets to a point where it says no more and the pitchforks and torches come out. And then by that point, it's usually too late. And those transitions tend to be very painful for everybody. So it's really not something for us all to wish for. So I was going to ask this question later, but since you brought it up, I'm going to ask it now. So Sven, I make you emperor. Okay.
What
reforms would you prioritize most in the near term?
Well, I think we need to get through the crisis first. I think the issue is that you have, at this point, still no political real unity to tackle complex solutions. I think that's worse. I mean, by the way, about democracy in general, I think politicians for the last 20 years have lived off the easy money policies of central bankers, because then anything goes back, central bankers come in. Central bankers, in my mind, have also gotten simply too powerful because of their permanent interventions. We are now in a phase where literally, we just saw it this summer, right? Jay Powell says neutral and we got a 20% rally.
Right.
He says pain and we drop you know, massively on the stock market. I mean, do you want to be in a situation where one person has that much power just by what he decides to say one day to the next?
Well, not at all. And sorry to interrupt, but you raise a really important point here, which is in that environment, you can't be an investor. You're forced to be a speculator. You're just forced to guess what's the next thing that Powell is going to say, because that overwhelms every other part of the market action.
That's why the machination between technicals and what's happening on liquidity and financial conditions in context of the mission is so important to understand. So when you see a rally like we just had in mid-June, it goes to key resistance points where everybody's bullish again. You mentioned earlier about positive technical signal. I thought the technical signals were horrible because they're massively jammed, overbought. We had negative divergences, and we approach key resistance points. If you expect this just to continue, you know, you got to know when you know you're wrong, right? And so for us, it was just lightening up, scaling out. And then when we got to these points, it's purely try some shorts here, because that just simply from a technical perspective didn't make sense. It also didn't make sense from a macro perspective. What was really better? You know, why was Apple all of a sudden flat on a year? Based on what? You know, and based on everything that's going on the fundamental basis, no way, no how, right? So that, and likewise, you know, if we get some larger pullback again here in the fall, we'll be flexible enough to again push for a long positioning if the signals tell us to do that. You can't be perma anything in this environment. You know, you can't be a hero chasing up Bed Bath and Beyond from 10 to 28.
And then from knock 28 back to 9 in a couple of days.
Knock your socks off, but know when to leave the party, right? I mean, that's just common sense, I would hope, you know. But it's the problem is we're not only subject to central bankers, but we're also subject to conditioned behavior over the last 14 years. So markets, you know, it's been long said, you know, markets can be irrational longer than you can remain solvent. Yeah. So our opinions really don't matter. It's just what matters is how we can identify the pivots and the drivers of a market at any given time. Going back to the original question though, with structural reforms, it's tough. I'm really worried that the democratic system as we know it is becoming increasingly ineffectual in being able to deal with complex solutions. Mm-hmm. We see it across the world. I think in the United States is probably as bad as I've seen it in my lifetime. You know, people like to blame all kinds of factors, including social media. You know, I mean, I get my own share of, you know, people going at me and like they wouldn't if they were to meet me face to face. You know, right. There's this kind of perceived safety filter. You can talk to anyone you like without consequences. But I think it's just a reflection of the fact that the middle class has been shrinking for 40 years. We keep telling ourselves we're in the greatest economy ever, but it's really not working for a lot of people. And we have no accountability at all from those that are benefiting from these type of policies. I can argue on the positive side, yeah, global poverty has improved over the last few decades, but it's still terrible, you know, and you cannot have a long-term functioning society with a shrinking middle class. It's just not going to work. You know, I think it was good that they helped out people with stimulus checks, those that needed it, but then I saw them also throwing out millions to PPP recipients, businesses that A, didn't really need it, or that got full loan forgiveness about this. I think that's sending the wrong signal as well. And then in general, you know, if you look at right now, for example, it's fascinating again, how much money is going into buybacks as opposed to CapEx. These companies are throwing more into buybacks than CapEx. Okay. And look at the last few crises. You know, companies, take airlines, for example, airlines that spend billions and billions and billions on buybacks.
Got bailed out
because that's the message. If you're running a business, you got to be at least be prepared. We all personally responsible have to be prepared for a crisis, an unforeseen circumstance. We got to be able to handle something terrible happen. So we need to have cash reserves to do that. But these policies that have been played out over the years have basically sent the message, you can be as reckless as you want, because ultimately someone's going to bail you out. And guess what that has created? It's called a zombification of the economy. It's like close to 25% of the companies on the Russell 2000, is it, or Russell 3000, are zombie companies. They have more debt obligations than they what they throw in terms of results.
Right, which is why cost of care is becoming so important right now, because it's exactly the conflagration that takes them all out.
Exactly. Yeah, because that shoe is still to drop, you know, as these rate hikes filter through the economy. And guess who's going to get hurt?
Well, certainly all the employees that work for those companies, but exactly, you know, the taxpayers who fund the bailouts and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, would Emperor Sven make buybacks illegal again like they used to be?
I think buybacks, I have generally no problem with it. I mean, it's a free society. They're free companies. They can do what they want. But I would make it very clear, there would be, if you do buybacks, go knock your socks off. But you're not going to get any bailouts whatsoever. And in fact, maybe I would say, you know, if you want to do buybacks, you can do it under certain conditions, meaning you have built up enough cash reserves, you know, in terms of being a viable company. We are not going to bail you out. We don't want you to become a systemic issue.
Yeah, exactly. Because the airlines are a good example. You know, they can sort of put a gun to their head and say, well, hey, we were reckless, but you don't want your airline industry to go away overnight, right? And so you may want to put some guardrails in place there. All right, God, I'd love to keep going down this path with you, but we're beginning to get a little tight on time, and I still got some key questions to get to, like, you know, what assets do you think will perform well or poorly given the environment you see ahead? But let's actually start kind of from the technical side, which is at a high level, as you look at the current technicals and are addressing the question, okay, does it look like we are still in a bear market? Was this rally that we just saw, you know, not a breakout, but really just a, you know, a relief rally within a larger bear market? Is that the case? If so, how much lower do you think this thing could go? What are the technicals telling you right now?
Okay, so in mid-June when I made that...
Our interview with Sven will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as the little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And remember, we're continuing our new practice of publishing my top takeaways from these weekly interviews. To get mine from this interview with Sven for free, just go to wealthion.com/AdamsNotes. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook Sven has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little nervous about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no-strings-attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks that Sven has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our interview with Sven Henrich.